The following is a point of view program. Opinions expressed are those of the participants.
Good evening. This is In Other Words Radio, and I'm Amy Sullenberg. And I'm really excited about this next hour. I am speaking with three health professionals about healthy approaches to dealing with some pretty big problems, in particular, a problem of climate change. How do we both take action, encourage solutions in ways that encourage others, bring hope, avoid going down in some depressive road? We're going to talk about psychological and societal barriers to creating meaningful change regarding climate change and how we can get around those. So it'll be an exciting hour, and I want to thank my three guests or conversationalists here, Kevin Doerr, Beth Schenk, and Jen Robom. So let me just introduce them briefly, and they'll introduce themselves a little bit more. We have Kevin, who's a clinical psychologist here in Missoula, and Jen, who is also a clinical psychologist and director of the Clinical Psychology Center at the University of Montana here in Missoula, and then Beth Schenk, who is a nurse. So three really smart PhDs who think a lot about this stuff. Who would like to jump in? Beth, go ahead.
Thank you, Amy. It's a pleasure to be here, and I look forward to our conversation as well. My name is Beth Schenk. I'm a practicing registered nurse here in Missoula, and I do think about these issues a lot. I'm particularly interested in the environmental impacts of healthcare, and even more specifically of nursing practice. I work on this issue both at a hospital here in Missoula and in some of my own research, where I have looked at nurses' perceptions of some of these problems and what they do about them, and also through my work at Washington State University College of Nursing, where I'm on the faculty.
Great. Kevin?
Yeah, thanks for having us, Amy. Really appreciate it. I think it's just so important that we have these kind of conversations here in our community. But I'm Kevin Doerr. I'm a psychologist in private practice here in Missoula. I'm also an affiliate staff member at the University of Montana. And I lecture quite a bit on some of the psychological and emotional barriers that we have to overcome in order to meaningfully address climate change.
And hi, I'm Jen Robom. I'm the director of the Clinical Psychology Center. I also work with the Family Medicine Residency of Western Montana, and I think a lot about the intersection of health and mental health and the impact of climate change on both. So I'd love to talk with these guys about how do we cope with that.
Great. Well, thank you for being here. This is In Other Words Radio, and you can find an audio of tonight's conversation if you want to share with friends at inotherwordsradio.com. And so let's just jump in. I'm curious, Kevin, you talked about thinking a lot about these psychological and societal barriers that kind of prevent us from dealing with the problems that arise. Can you talk more about the research and the thinking that you do or along those lines?
Yeah, no, I do think a lot about it. And one of the things I would say about it, Amy, is that one of the things that keeps us from being able to deal effectively with climate change is due in part to the way our brains are actually wired. And so if you look at the way that our brain has evolved over the years, we're much better at dealing with immediate threats. So, for example, if the four of us were hiking up in Glacier National Park and we saw a grizzly bear, we would do a great job in terms of responding to that threat, hopefully. And however, with climate change, it occurs very gradually, and our brain has a harder time responding effectively to threats that are gradual in time. And we end up actually adapting to real gradual changes so that we normalize it. And so we've kind of normalized climate change in a way that it doesn't trip the alarm center in our brain in the same way that a grizzly bear might. And so one metaphor that Daniel Gilbert from Harvard uses is that it's like we're sleeping in a bed and it's on fire and our alarm system isn't triggered to get out of bed and do something in response to that.
Right. People think about it in terms of that frog in the boiling water that slowly you turn up the heat and the frog's still sitting there until
exactly
can't jump out.
Yeah. And then another person whose writings that are very influential for me, his name is Daniel Kahneman. And he won a Nobel Prize in the area of behavioral economics. And he writes a lot about how we have two operating systems in our brain. And so one operating system is this very quick, emotionally based, instinctual, automatic system, you know, that guides most of our behavior. The second operating system is more deliberative, it's slow, it's effortful, it's more rational, it's more conscious. But as it turns out, system one dictates most of our behavior. And as it relates to climate change, it's really important that we're able to step back and reflect on what's going on and be much more future-oriented in the way that we do our planning. But System 1's not designed that way at all. I mean, another metaphor that comes to my mind, and this comes from Jonathan Haidt, and Jonathan talks about how System 1 is really like an elephant, and System 2 is like the person riding the elephant. And as it turns out, the elephant is basically in control of most of our behavior. And the rider is just being totally taken around by this elephant. And often the rider just actually acts like an attorney for the elephant in terms of coming up with post hoc explanations of what the elephant's up to. But I think it's really important for us to understand what the elephant really is up to, because it really represents most of our nervous system and most of our reactions to the world at large. As it relates to climate change, I would give a couple of suggestions around that. One of them is that if you really understand the elephant has a really hard time responding to abstract things in our life. And so when we deal with climate change, or when we try to educate people on climate change, often it's couched in information, scientific data, and that kind of stuff. And it's really difficult for the elephant to respond to that effectively. The elephant is much better, or that part of us is much better at responding to things that are concrete or that are personally relevant to our lives. And so one of the suggestions I would make around that is that if you can make climate change relevant to people's lives here, like in Western Montana, mm-hmm. they can connect it in that way, they're much more likely to respond effectively to it. And so an example of that would be to help people connect the dots in terms of like wildfire activity in the summer, you know, less snowpack as a result of climate change, how that affects, you know, water shortages here in Western Montana and so forth. And if we can connect it in that way, make it more, or humanize and make it more relevant to our lives, we're much more likely to respond to it. The other thing I would say about the elephant too, or that first operating system, is that it has a hard time responding to events that are far off into the future. Mm-hmm. And it does much better to, once again, more immediate threats or things that are in the here and now. And even though a majority of people in the United States agree that climate change is happening and see humans as at least in part, you know, responsible for climate change, only about 1 in 4 see it as having an immediate threat to their lives. And if you ask simply a question like, how might climate change affect you in the next 10 years, very few people can actually respond to that question. And I think it's really important that we make it relevant to what's happening right here, right now, versus a faraway event. Because if you can do that and help people connect, once again, their lives to what's to climate change and how it's affecting them in the here and now, then we're much more likely to respond to it.
I have a thought, Kevin. Just I'm curious what you know about this in terms of, is it possible also to change the expectations of the elephant? So as you're describing it, I understand what you're saying, that it's difficult for the elephant to think abstractly, difficult to project into the future or even across space into other parts of the world. Right. And yet that's our reality. So I'm just wondering, in terms of global change, how we might help this aspect of our psyche and of our predictable behavior to change. So an example might be, if we looked at how an elephant of this description might have behaved in the 30s or 40s with a whole different milieu around them in terms of technology and transportation and that sort of thing, it would have been different than it is now. So I'm just wondering, and this may be too far out there as a question, but I'm wondering what you know about that in terms of societal change and expectation in that way compared to individual change.
Yeah, no, I think that there are changes going on. In some ways, you can think about it that we're actually rewiring our brains in the here and now. And one of the ways that we're doing that, for example, is through the internet. The internet helps us stay globally connected, and so we begin to think more about events that are not just happening locally, but that are happening across the world. So I think that's happening, but the progress is pretty slow. And the way that the brain evolves, it evolves over a long period of time. Now, with the unique challenges of climate change, we have to respond to it right now. To wait for the brain to evolve to a point to where we think more globally, it may be too late by then. But one of the things that comes to my mind is I think it's really important that we're able to strengthen what I call the continuity between the present and the future self. But the reality, though, is that the present self is in charge of our behavior. But if we can strengthen that continuity where we can begin to expand our perspective so that we can see ourselves in the future, 20 years from now, 40 years from now, 100 years from now, that kind of stuff, then we're much more likely to respond effectively to climate change. Now, we know from research that individuals who have that capacity just do much better in life. They're more successful and they thrive and so forth. And so a really well-known test regarding that is based on a series of experiments they did in the 60s and 70s at Stanford. It's known as the marshmallow test. And in that particular test, what they did was they took kids between the ages of roughly 3 to 6, and the researcher would sit down with them at a table, and they would place sometimes a marshmallow, other times it was like a pretzel or a cookie, and they would place it on the table, and they would say to the child that, "I'm going to leave for a few minutes." And it was actually about 15 minutes, which is a long time for a 4 or 5 year old. And they would say, and if I come back, that cookie or that marshmallow is still there, then you get 2. Okay, so you can imagine how hard that is, right? And so the researcher would leave, and actually I saw a videotape because they replicated this research, you know, recently. And the kids that were successful would distract themselves by singing songs. They would sit on their hands and that kind of stuff to keep from grabbing, you know, the marshmallow. Some of the kids would grab the marshmallow before the researcher would even get out of his or her chair and eat it. But what we know from research, because we would follow these kids over time, is that kids that were most successful and had better life outcomes were the ones who were able to restrain themselves and to think in the future, in this case 15 minutes in the future, so that they would have, you know, better results, right? As a society right now, we're really being asked to do that. We're being asked to delay our immediate gratification, in particular around our use of carbon-based fuels, and to plan for a future so that our children and grandchildren and so forth will be taken care of. And we really need to pass the marshmallow test right now. Mm-hmm. Now, our brains aren't that great at it, though. And so, because once again, the present self is always in control, and there's that part of our brain that responds to immediacy. And so if there's something that will gratify us in the immediate present, we're much more likely to do that. I mean, you think of other examples of that. I mean, we all know, for example, that if you exercise on a regular basis and if you eat well and that kind of stuff, right, that you'll have a better outcome in the future. But how many people actually do that? You know, we often don't do that because we respond to the immediacy in our environment, you know, the chocolate bar that's waiting for us and that kind of stuff. And so it's just an example to me of how the elephant often rules the day in that way. And the elephant is really responding to immediacy. And we have to learn how to be able to step back and to use that second operating system Daniel Kahneman talks about so we'd be more reflective and make better decisions for the future, especially for our children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren.
So, Jen, I was curious in listening to Kevin, what jumps to your mind? Because, one, I know you have a 12-year-old who probably likes marshmallows. but how do we, encourage people to hold off on that marshmallow? That, I mean, they're easy because I don't like marshmallows, but chocolate maybe, coffee. I don't know. What are you thinking, Jen, about some of these ideas?
Well, I was trying to remember a statistic that I'd heard. I think something like 99% of people break their New Year's resolutions within the first week or the first month or something like that. So we really aren't great at deferring sort of immediate gratification for long-term stuff. But I was thinking, as Kevin was talking about, even a way of working in psychotherapy called acceptance and commitment therapy that was done by Stephen Hayes and a couple of his colleagues, where part of our job is to help folks really observe what's going on inside of them, what their cravings are, what their feelings are, what their thoughts are, to not get hooked by them and pushed around by them. And one thought was, what would happen if we were able to tolerate a little bit better our desires for things right now, but we could hold off if we were thinking about what we want for the future? And I think that's a key to behavior change in general, is how do we link things to our values? So how do I link things to my love for my son and my desire for him to have a planet that's more habitable? How do I think about the things that matter most to me, and can I align my behavior now with those values? So I know, again, Hayes and his colleagues, they're helping us think about how do I change a behavior like smoking, or how do I manage even depressive feelings right now in the moment. But I think there's something to be said for thinking about those ideas along the lines of climate change. How do we think about, again, changing our consumption or deferring gratification now to make a world that's more like the one that we want?
I think sometimes as well that the facts help a bit, mm-hmm. and it seems, except we know that it doesn't always help, because if the facts and awareness were all that were required, then no one would smoke cigarettes, for instance, right. Because it's so well known. But as you were both talking about this sense of, or the need to defer immediate gratification in some cases, not in all cases, and the tendency for us not to, I think of this area of consumption, which you mentioned, Joan, in several different ways. One is financial. So we know about that, and we know that many people, I think approaching half of people, have significant credit card debt in the U.S. and yet tend to live outside of their financial means again. We know that a third of Americans are obese, and I think it's over half now that are overweight. And again, eating outside of their means, more than what they need or really what is healthy for them. And we know the same about the Earth's resources. We're living outside of the means of the planet right now. And you've probably heard the quote that if all people lived like Americans, we'd need five planets worth of resources. So I think that's an interesting conundrum that ties into this idea of gratification and how much thinking can impact or doesn't impact. For me, because facts impact me, it helps to understand, oh, I see, if we continue to burn fossil fuels as we are, we have a fairly predictable outcome next. Do you see that in your practice, either of you helping with people?
I'll jump in on that. I mean, I think knowledge is really critical, although one of the charges against therapy over the years has been you can get people with a lot of insight into their problems and they still don't make changes. So I think information is very important, but if the information is scary, we're more likely to split that off, I think, from the facts. So we might have a good intellectual understanding, but if we're so overwhelmed or so terrified about what those facts might mean, that can lead us to some paralysis or a sense of hopelessness. And so I think part of our charge is to make people appreciate how scary some of that is, but also make them feel like there's something that can be done about it. Otherwise, I think they'll just shut down, which is not to blame them. I think we all do that. It's a very normal defense mechanism for coping with really terrifying things. And, you know, the long-term picture for climate change can feel really terrifying and really paralyzing. So I think one of our charges is how to help people feel like there's something I can do, even in the face of something that feels as big and scary as this can be.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. And what I would say is if we went to a party and if we wanted to kill the conversation, we would start talking about climate change, right? And in part because of what Jen's speaking to is that it's overwhelming for people. And so some of the defense mechanisms we use are denial, avoidance, numbing, that sort of thing. Now, one of the things that I think is important, and certainly as healthcare professionals, we try to promote this, is just the concept of it's actually better if you lean into things that cause you discomfort. And I would say out of the workshops that I give around town and my work with clients, that's probably the number one principle where I get positive feedback from people. Once they get that principle that leaning into something is better than avoiding it, they just say, oh, my gosh, my life is so much better.
And so what's an example of that leaning in terms of this conversation?
Yeah, and so leaning into it would be leaning into the, like Beth's saying, the facts that the weather and climate is changing tremendously, you know, around the world, and certainly even here in Western Montana, we've noticed changes over the last 15 years that are really tremendous, and then being able to respond effectively to that. Now, what we know is that there's a big part of our nervous system that's geared toward wanting pleasure and avoiding pain, right? And so, of course, it's only natural that we'd want to avoid some of the information that we're getting regarding climate change and some of the effects that it has on our life. Now, what I do know from research in terms of what allows people to thrive is that sometimes people just make the simple distinction, is a person, do they have an avoidance orientation or what they call an approach orientation? And what they mean by that is with respect to things that make them uncomfortable. And what we know from research is that people that really thrive, who really do well and very successful in their lives, they have what they call an approach orientation in life. And there's actually some really cool brain science around this too, just in terms of some recent research they've done with people like with approach orientation, how their brain begins to light up when they have that kind of orientation. And the centers that light up in the brain are associated with happiness and contentment. That actually, if you lean into things that are uncomfortable and learn how to do that, you'll actually be happier in life. And certainly that's been my overwhelming experience in working with people for 25 years in my practice as a psychologist, that when they learn how to lean into discomfort, they do much better. Now, avoidance, what I would say is that all it does is give you temporary relief. Right. But if you track it over time, the research is really clear that anxiety and avoidance go hand in glove. And what I mean by that is that the more you avoid, the more anxious you'll become. The more that you lean into stuff, the more you'll be able to calm your nervous system, self-regulate, and also use that second operating system I was referring to earlier that will allow you to reflect and make conscious choices that are in your best interests in the long run.
I'll jump in again about that. I was thinking of a piece I read by a woman named Rosemary Randall in the UK who talks a lot about having to do some grief work. And I think as a clinician, we see that where sometimes if somebody's having trouble with a breakup or the loss of a loved one, if they're, again, shying away from those feelings or the thoughts about that person, it can actually prolong the grief process as opposed to leaning in, really feeling the loss, making a point of mourning and maybe creating rituals for making that happen can help somebody move through that. One of the things that Randall was talking about is this idea of if we keep deferring our grief to the future, if we keep thinking that, well, climate change is going to happen in the future, so I don't have to think about it right now, that actually makes the world even, or sorry, the future even scarier and a bigger problem. If we're able to, as Kevin was saying, lean into the mourning that we need to do for some of the way that we live right now, for some of the plane trips we won't be able to take, for some of the things we may not be able to buy. You know, we giggle a little bit at that, but I think we're all dealing with that. We all have to give up some things that we care about that shape how we feel about ourselves and how we feel comfortable in the world. We all have to give up some of that and more than that, I think, if we're going to move forward. And she talks about creating spaces where we can do that kind of collectively or in small groups where we actually, again, make space to do some of that mourning so that we can move forward. And that's just like any grief process. You know, we have to do some mourning before we can think about what the next chapter is going to look like. What's my life going to be like after this person is gone? I think we have to do the same with climate change. So leaning into those feelings so that we can move forward to creating a new future.
Yeah, no, I would totally agree with that. The other thing I would add to that is another fundamental truth, as I see it, is that grief and gratitude are intimately connected to one another. And so the ability to mourn and grieve allows people to be more grateful, more engaged. The danger in using the defense mechanisms of avoidance, numbing, and denial is that it causes people to be disengaged from their lives and disengaged from the world as a whole. The more that we can be engaged with our world, even if it's changing radically and in some ways that threaten us, the happier people are. And the more grateful you are for what we do have around us. And certainly here in Western Montana, we're blessed with so much beauty all around us. Mm-hmm. And to me, the deeper that we engage in that and try to protect it, the better off we are as a community, but also the more grateful we are and the more alive we feel.
I'm interested in the idea of mourning and what comes after that, because my experience, and I'm not a mental health professional, but my experience is once a change is accepted and moved through, other things start to be revealed. And so new ways of thinking, new solutions to problems. And so in a certain sense, when I think about a healthy community or healthy communities, healthy families, healthy social structures, some of them seem to be healthier once some of these stressors have been let go of. So for instance, you might say to deal with climate change, we're going to have to give up driving our car everywhere. But guess what? It works out really well mm-hmm. if people start walking, getting out on their bikes. We see each other more, we exercise more, we can appreciate what's happening in the weather and in the day and in the mountains more. And so there's this surprising co-benefit of moving in a different direction that you could say was caused by a certain lack, but really it opens up more possibilities. So I'm interested in that in other ways as well, not just transportation and energy use, but local foods, et cetera.
Yeah, no, I would totally agree with that. And because you can see it as a sacrifice, but you can also see it as a gain in terms of some of the changes that are being demanded of us. And I'll just give you a personal example that's in keeping with what Beth was just talking about. There was a time when I was on a board here in Missoula, and we were trying to create more infrastructure for walking and biking. And my office is about 2 miles from my house, and I was driving my car often to my office. And certainly being engaged in that And as Jim was pointing out earlier, my deeper value was regarding, you know, trying to protect our environment, not being in my car so much and so forth. Now, what would happen is behavioral change is really difficult. So even though I had this value in mind, I wouldn't necessarily act on it, because what I would do is I would rationalize in the morning. I would say, okay, I'm going to walk or bike today. And then, you know, time would kind of slip by. I'd be helping my daughter get ready for school and that sort of thing. And then I'd be, oh, I only got 10 minutes, so I'm just going to drive today. But tomorrow I will walk or bike, right? And that's part of the reason why it's so important to understand how our elephant operates, because in that case, the elephant was in control, and the other part of me was just rationalizing what the elephant was up to, right? And so understanding that, I knew that I needed to ritualize this change. And ritualizing it means to do it on a daily basis for long enough to where it becomes a new automatic for me so that it's under the control of the elephant over time. But for me to be able to do that, you know, I had to do something pretty radical because my ability to rationalize is so fantastic that I actually took the insurance off my car for a few months because I knew that would force my hand in terms of I couldn't drive my car that way. So I took the insurance off my car for about just a few months, and then I got into that rhythm of biking and walking to the office. And then once I was able to do that for a few months, I was able to put the insurance back in my car, and it was no big deal. I wasn't tempted at that point. Now, one of the benefits of that, number one, I was able to ritualize it, so I was able to create the behavioral change I was really after, right? Mm-hmm. But secondly, what I realized is I didn't want to be in my car after that, as Beth's mm-hmm. pointing out, that biking and walking to work and having that experience was so wonderful. Most of the time I would walk up like Higgins Avenue and the shop owners would be opening their stores. I would see people that I knew. I'd have these wonderful conversations. And the idea of being in this bubble, meaning in my car, was totally unappealing to me. And I felt so much more alive and so much more connected to my community. And so in that way, I think we can create changes that are more sustainable, but also allow us to be healthier and to thrive and to feel happier and more satisfied in our lives.
So one thing that I noticed is there's lots of people setting great examples. I think you three here are wonderful. One thing that I'm really curious about is how you approach actually moving beyond just setting an example and actually talking to your friends or colleagues or neighbors about why you do what you do. Is that piece of it is important to not just do it, but also engage others in maybe the same activity, but also in why you want to do what you're doing? And sort of when do you bring climate change into the conversation? Because we do know it can be a downer at a party, or as Jen and I've talked about before.
Well, I do this with a fair amount of my time, really, in terms of working with healthcare professionals who are thinking about this, want to think about it more. And I think that it's good to apply some science to this as well. So okay. People have only a certain amount of tolerance for being challenged or being feeling threatened in terms of what you're talking about, and including in asking them to make change. So I think it's really helpful to keep it positive. And this is really talking with people I don't know well. Talking with people I know well, it's more like, well, how do you deal with this and how do you do that? But in terms of talking with people I don't know well, I think it's important to, as Jen alluded to earlier, really identify the values behind it. Why is something important? Why would we care about it? In the healthcare profession, that's pretty easy because mm-hmm. it's so linked to health. The not just climate change, but the presence of toxic chemicals in our food or in our air, in our water. So a number of environmental issues make good sense to healthcare people because part of our job is not only treating illness once it's arrived, but preventing illness, so creating healthy communities, creating healthy families. So I think always relating it back to a person or professional's sense of purpose is helpful.
Yeah, the thing I would add to that is that I think it's important that we're not proselytizing to others, you know, because people don't want to be preached to in terms of, you know, the kind of changes that we feel like they should make, that sort of thing. But I think that there's just so much power by leading by example. And we know from sociological research that people's behavior influences in dramatic ways. And that's true in research they've done with obesity, smoking, happiness, depression, so forth. So like with happiness, for example, if you know someone in your life who's really happy, there's over 15% greater chance that you'll be happy too. I mean, it really impacts on people in that kind of way. Now, I would say the same thing holds up with sustainability. We know, for example, that like with power bills, there's been research on this, that if you're given information regarding your neighbors and then reducing their use in terms of the amount of energy they're using in their home, it impacts on people so that they're more motivated to reduce their energy bill too, or their energy usage.
Right. I've heard that. So if you just know how you stand relative to your neighbors in general, not individually, they don't identify
like absolutely
Sam next door, Sally down the road, but how you rank absolutely next to your neighbors and who's going up and who's going down.
Definitely. And I would say that with respect to all kinds of sustainable behaviors, whether it's walking or biking or what have you, that when people see you do that, even if you're not saying,
talking,
you
know,
extolling the virtues of that kind of stuff, people see it.
Okay.
And you're leading by example. It has an impact on them. And the likelihood that they're going to follow suit is much greater.
I want to ask Beth, I want to ask you a question because I think you've worked with the hospital systems. And I'm thinking all the things we're talking about are really at the individual level. And there is some, you know, there's some research to say, well, if we're all recycling more or putting in the new fancy swirly light bulbs, we're doing our part, when in fact that's actually going to make a relatively small change in the overall problem. And so while I think it's really important for us to think about what we can do on an individual level, I'm also wondering about systemic changes in larger systems. You know, if I'm a a single mom and I have five kids and I'm trying to figure out how to get everybody to school on time, riding my bike may not feel like a possibility, even if it's consistent with my values. So I'm just wondering about what sort of bigger changes we can make that can support people.
Well, working in large organizations, I'm very interested in the way that the organizational structures lead to individual behavior. So a simple example is having a trash can next to every recycling bin or vice versa, so that people don't have to look for where they can recycle. So you make it easy and clear, make it hard not to recycle. So you're putting in structural elements that guide individual behavior. So I think that's very important. And I think that we can see that when we look at how different countries approach some of these issues. So some of that can be led and guided in those ways. So for instance, in Germany, their waste stream, eventually 4% of it gets to their landfill. In the U.S., it's something like 78%. So how do they do that? There's lots of ways they do that. Some of it's through their policies and laws. Some of it's through their the availability that they have through their corporate work, including waste treatment. And some of it's cultural expectation. So a lot of those things can be designed and implemented at a more of a system level so that the individual is not faced with this impossible dilemma. How am I going to feed my children or contribute to lessening my environmental impact? It's really sort of an impossible situation. And so I think that this is the rider of the elephant trying to think through these things for all of us as a collective. Hard to do. And then we get into some of the issues that we don't agree on in terms of who should be in control of those decisions. But I think it's clear that when we can orchestrate our behaviors more collectively, we will make a lot more progress. However, I would want to add that individual behavior, in my opinion, is still very important. Because when you think about how we've gotten incrementally as far as we have with the heating of the frog in the water or the movement of the elephant, it was really a number of individual actions. You know, once fossil fuels were unleashed, it was individuals who were using the fossil fuels. Now, yes, we have to leash back in fossil fuels, but in the meantime, if 7 billion people are making the situation worse, it's going to get worse a lot faster than if 7 billion people individually are trying to make it better.
So what we do individually matters, and then it seems like as people get more and more, they do things individually, a lot of times they do start to get together and say, hey, I do want to continue, you know, these solar panels are working great for me. Everybody should be able to have them. How do we then have that policy? Well, we better elect the right people that will be willing to help us with those policies and continue to move that forward. So it does seem like there's a lot of really exciting things happening at local levels. Not just because it's local, but because local people are coming together and saying, hey, we want more of this. I don't know. That's where I become optimistic, is seeing communities like Missoula, other places in Western Montana and around the country where they're really making a lot of change at the local level. And that is trickling up.
Well, I think in a way, Amy, what you're talking about is taking individuals, that there's power in, as Beth is saying, in individual choices. But the more individuals you have making those choices, and then the kind of synchronicity that comes with doing them simultaneously, and the sense of community, and then more advocacy, and then more political change, it gets more of a life of its own.
I'm just going to break in just to say that this is In Other Words Radio, and I'm Amy Silberg talking with three really smart, thoughtful health professionals in Missoula, Montana, Jen Robum, Beth Shank, and Kevin Doerr. Where do we want to go next with this conversation? Kevin.
I have one idea just in terms of, I was talking about brain science earlier, and I don't want to be a downer in terms of our brains are wired in a way that we're not going to be able to deal effectively with climate change. Because our brains are wired in ways that will allow us to deal effectively with climate change too. And so most of the new revolution in our brain, for example, has to do with the prefrontal cortex, which does allow us to imagine, to plan for the future, and to be creative and to problem solve in an incredible way. And so we can imagine a radically different future than we have now. Not only a future in which we're less reliant on carbon-based fuels, but also a future in which our emotional and social well-being is front and center. And to me, that's really important. The other thing I would say about our brain in terms of how it's wired is that in response to threat, there are two broad responses that researchers often talk about. One of them is the fight-flight response. And so all of us know that, right? Mm-hmm. You feel threatened by something, you either try to fight back or you flee. and it's deeply wired into our nervous system. But also we have what some people call the tend and befriend response, and that's our ability to come together in a beautiful way as a community or society and really help each other out and be cooperative and be compassionate toward one another. And to me, that's the response that we have to really cultivate with respect to climate change and some of the effects it's going to have, because it's very likely, as scientists are saying, that there's going to be water shortages, mass migrations, that kind of stuff, and not this so distant future. And our ability to really support one another is going to be really important, you know, so that we don't get locked into that freak out or that fight flight response. Now, we've seen lots of examples of that. So one example was after Hurricane Sandy. The way that people came together and supported one another in response to that event was just incredible. In our own local community here, there was an avalanche from Mount Jumbo mm-hmm. that we all know about. Mm-hmm. And the way that our community came together regarding that mm-hmm. and supported one another was just phenomenal. And so those are two really cool examples in my mind of that tend and befriend response. And that's something that we can really nurture in our local communities and society as a whole.
Yeah, and some of the research that I've read has been that the more that communities are already working together and have established, whether it's programs or, you know, neighborhood councils or people that are thinking about making their community better, preparing for a future, the more that those are already in existence prior to some event like a, you know, Hurricane Sandy or some big tragic event, the better that community then bounces back or moves themselves in a more positive direction after some kinds of a tragic event. So they're sort of primed to continue to improve and build a community in a way that's really cohesive.
Absolutely, because it builds resilience. Because another way of thinking about that idea of leaning into discomfort is that that's necessary to build resilience. And as a community and as a society, as these events continue to come at us in terms of some of the weather changes that we're noticing and how it impacts on our local communities, the more we're able to lean into it, it'll activate resources within us, including our ability to reach out to one another, to be more empathic, to be more compassionate, to be more relationship-oriented. And to me, that's going to serve us not only in terms of adapting to things as a result of climate change, but also as a way of creating a sense of well-being in general in our community.
Well, I think you're both talking about almost ways that could be prescriptions for a community to mm-hmm. become resilient and able to adapt in the face of threat. What other elements of that would be part of such a prescription? How do we create healthy, thriving communities?
Well, to me, that's so important. You know, in my view, if we just set aside climate change and we just talked about how can we maximize our sense of well-being as a community, If we just follow the research on that, we would create a very sustainable community or society. Mm-hmm. And so one of the researchers that comes to mind is Tim Kasser. And Tim Kasser and his colleagues talk about what he calls extrinsic versus intrinsic goals. And so when people pursue extrinsic goals, which would include being, you know, trying to be popular, have the right status, have the right image, accumulating material goods and that kind of stuff, that's, you know, pursuing intrinsic goals. Extrinsic goals. And pursuing intrinsic goals would be things like pursuing personal growth, becoming more accepting of oneself and others, be more relationship-oriented, more connected with family and friends, doing service work or giving back to the community and that sort of thing. And when you follow people that have those two broad orientations, people that pursue extrinsic goals tend to be more anxious and depressed. They have a higher likelihood of engaging in substance abuse behavior. They are less satisfied with their life and so on. Whereas people who pursue intrinsic goals, those individuals tend to be much happier, they thrive, they're more satisfied with their lives and so on. And consumer-oriented culture, which is in part the culprit of us using too many resources and contributing to, you know, the climate change, really emphasizes values connected with extrinsic goals. And so to me, if we made a conscious shift within our community to pursue intrinsic goals where we're savoring life, we're being more engaged with one another, we're doing more service work, we're helping each other out and so on, it's going to serve us not only in terms of maximizing our sense of well-being here in our community, but also in effectively dealing with climate change and creating a more sustainable community.
Kev, what would you say for our neighbors, again, who are just trying to keep their heads above water, who might say, well, I'd love to put some time and energy into personal growth, but right now I'm just trying to keep the heat on. How would you include them in that vision?
Well, in terms of that vision, I mean, obviously we still have to work and, you know, put food on the table and that sort of thing. But the, you know, what Tim Kasser is referring to as intrinsic goals, those don't cost money, you know, and it's just a matter of reprioritizing our lives and focusing on things that really have meaning and value. the other part of pursuing intrinsic goals is in keeping with, like with Beth's work, is making sure that all people have access to health care and that we're creating a community where people have clean air to breathe and clean water to drink and that sort of thing. And once again, to me, that's not, that just makes good sense. But economically, you know, it's not going to cost any more to do that than what we're doing right now.
Jen, did you have some other ideas about how to do what Kevin was speaking about? Because you've thought a lot about that in terms of, you know, people having so much on their plate.
I wish I had better ideas. I think often when I'm engaging with folks in these conversations, that some of what comes into my mind is kind of who's not in the room and whose experience isn't being represented. And again, I sometimes think it's easy for us to think that everybody's wrestling with the same struggles that we are, when in fact some folks are pretty stressed out. Mm-hmm. And so it might feel like almost a luxury to worry about a problem that's going to happen 25 years from now than what I'm dealing with right now. So I wish I was so smart that I had an answer to that. It was just getting stirred up as Kevin was talking.
Well, I think that, again, back to sort of the co-benefit of working toward healthy, thriving communities, in fact, addresses some of that potential stress and need. Because, I mean, if we think about what are the elements of a healthy, thriving community, I mean, it seems like it would be a reduction in poverty is one. Mm-hmm. Food security is another. Tolerance and kindness is another. And eventually, hopefully, that will also lead to better policies and governmental roles, to the extent that that would help the poor and vulnerable. That's a key piece, I think, of all of this work, because this is not an elitist problem, and an elitist solution is not going to be a lasting solution, if there even is such a thing. And so I, again, see that this work is in the same direction, the work of really bringing justice and fairness and support, as well as tending to our problems that stem from our lifestyle and overconsumption and short-sightedness.
Yeah, I mean, you can think of some really direct ways that plays out. I mean, if we had policies and elected officials that were taking subsidies from fossil fuel companies and putting them into community programs that bring energy efficiency and conservation to low-income housing, and, you know, there is a lot of in Western Montana, and directly affected people's lives, they would have more money to be able to buy healthy food, to be able to do the things that they need to do, and they would have a direct benefit of not being so impacted as energy prices go up. They'd be buffered from that, and you can see that those policies could make a big difference to everybody's lives, and yet we're stalled out to some degree and making some of those big changes that we need to make, because they're policy changes and there's a lot of moneyed interests working against us there. And that's tough. That's where I get discouraged sometimes, is that the big moneyed interest, you would hope the larger interest would be towards communities that work better together. And when you see it working against that, it gets really frustrating. Yeah, but we don't want to end there.
We don't want to end there. No, I would definitely agree with that. But once again, you know, some of the things we're talking about in terms of creating a thriving, resilient community, I mean, certainly big moneyed interests impact on that to some degree, but we can empower ourselves in terms of creating that at a local level. And but even, you know, somebody mentioned a minute ago having kind of a stressed out lifestyle, but the ability to slow down and to really stay connected to one another and to take time for those connections, to me, big money doesn't have impact on that one way or another. Right. That's something that's totally within our power. The ability to be really grateful and protective of the resources that we have around us, that's totally within our power. They did a simple research study a couple of years ago where they would have people in the morning just get in touch with what really makes them feel grateful, and in particular, what gives them a sense of awe about being in the world. And so here in Western Montana, oh my gosh, there's so many things, from Flathead Lake to Glacier National Park to Mount Jumbo, Mount Sentinel here in Missoula, where if you just got up in the morning and really connected with that, the mm-hmm. resources and mm-hmm. the beauty around us, it makes a total difference. And that research study, what they showed was when people did that just for a few minutes in the morning, that their sense of time totally changed for the rest of the day. They felt less pressured. They felt less urgent. They felt calmer. They felt more connected, that sort of thing. And those are things that are within our power as human beings.
And we're so lucky, as you mentioned, in Western Montana. I've read some studies where, you know, 10 to 15 minutes of just being outside can change your stress levels, and they can measure those really directly. And then there's some studies that, you know, going to parks where there's more biodiversity, just more birds singing and more little critters running around, reduces people's stress, as opposed to just being, you know, being outside it's not in and of itself enough, but just going to places where it's a little quieter and there's other creatures evident really helps people's mental health.
It helps with physical health, too. It's, mm-hmm. in fact, in hospitals, we know that exposure to natural scenes and actual windows rather than photographs increases rate of healing in a variety of ways. It's a subtle effect, but it has been repeatedly measured. In fact, leading to a rule that's now decades old that all hospital rooms have to have a window if you're going to be there overnight. Yeah. So that's in part because it helps people to do better. Another recent study of a couple of years ago about healing environments in hospitals is that exposure to the natural world and especially an ability to get out into it from the hospital leads to decreased violence amongst patients who might be agitated. Interesting.
That is interesting. You know, the other thing I would say about, like, for example, here in Western Montana, is I think it's just so important to remember how much we have in common and to not allow political divisions and that sort of thing to separate us. And that's one of my concerns about the public dialogue that's happening in the United States mm-hmm. right now is there are just so many divisions. Mm-hmm. And we know from research in the area of cultural cognition, the way the elephant works is that the group that you identify most closely with, you will agree with whatever beliefs are associated with that group, even if the facts or information right. runs counter to that. I think it's important for us to be able to transcend that and to recognize that climate change isn't an issue that is specific to one group. It cuts across groups, it binds us, it connects us as a community. And for us to get better at being able to talk to not only people that we identify with or that we associate with, but people that in other groups too. And so one example in an unrelated field that comes to my mind regarding this that I speak to sometimes is it has to do with when Bush was president, it has to do with AIDS relief in Africa. And so one of the central people worldwide that was really focused on that was Bono, who is the lead singer for U2. And Bono was very interested in trying to free up monies in order to help out Africans that were dealing with AIDS. And he recognized that the U.S. was going to be a major player in that. And he ended up not only talking with George Bush, but in particular, he targeted Franklin Graham, who's the son of Billy Graham, who is, mm-hmm. he's an evangelist. And he targeted Jesse Helms, who is now deceased, but at that time was probably the most conservative member in the Senate and had been for many years. And he spoke with them, but he didn't speak to them within his own worldview. He was able to speak within their worldview. And he was able to talk about the importance of addressing that in the way that Christians would, in the way that Jesus would. And so one of the ways he framed it was that AIDS is sort of the leprosy of our day, and that if Jesus were alive, he'd be responding to it in this incredibly kind and compassionate way. And in speaking about it in that way, it totally made sense to people like Jesse Helms and Franklin Graham, and they were totally an advocate for that. And to me, that's a feather in the cap of the Bush administration. They freed up billions of dollars for AIDS, for relief for AIDS in Africa. And as it turns out, just as a side note, Jesse Helms went to a U2 concert and rocked out with these guys, right? And so they actually formed a bond around this, and a mm-hmm. bond that you just wouldn't imagine just in mm-hmm. terms of their different lifestyles, their different political beliefs, and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's an example of what we need to do as a community, to really come together and find our common ground and to not allow these divisions to divide us mm-hmm. anymore.
I think that really speaks to what Jen said earlier about acting from your values. And because I think everybody does, basically, unless maybe not psychopaths and sociopaths, I'm not sure. I look to the professionals here. But that small percentage aside, I think that would leave, 85 or 90% of us who really want to live well, want to do what's right, want to live in accordance with our values. I remember early on in some of my work, I looked at a study about Montanans' value of landscape and the natural environment. This was in relation to police force and education and other elements of a community, a healthy community. And something like 90% had one of those as their top two. So that told me, oh, we all care about the environment. We all care about having an intact landscape. We all care about clean air and water. And so to be able to link into that core value that is so universal for us, it would help dissolve some of these divisions that you were talking about, Kevin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree.
It seems like what I have heard a little bit is that health professionals like yourself, Beth, and you guys here are actually the most credible voices when it comes to people breaking down some of those barriers in terms of talking about global warming or thinking about it. kids that have asthma are going to be, and are right now already today, you know, having a harder time because of the changes in our atmosphere. So when health professionals speak of it from that lens, it clicks for people. They get it because they care so much about their own health and the health of their children. And I don't know, Beth, do you want to talk a little bit more about the links with physical health and climate and kind of how you approach those conversations?
Yes, there are a number of ways in which climate changes impact health, and we can think about this around the world, or we can think about it right here. So just briefly to address around the world, there's much more stress on the individual and on the way that they get what they need, like food and water. And so many of the changes that come that impact health directly are heat-related. So there's heat stress, there's dehydration, there's malnutrition that comes from it. It's also from a change in infection processes, so different vectors move into different niches that they were no longer there. So for instance, now we have even have seen dengue fever, which is a tropical disease as far north as Montana, very rarely, but we have seen that. And other diseases continue to move north. They're carried differently in different vectors and reservoirs around the world. Sequelae from climate-related events also cause tremendous loss. For instance, flooding, as we know, from superstorms and from more standing water flooding in some low-lying areas of the world. And we know that also from climate change. From fires that are at least heightened by climate change. We've seen that here. We know about risk of death from fighting fires. We know about risk of both lung disease and cardiac disease problems from longer-term exposure to smoke. And so there are a variety of ways in which climate change impacts health, both directly and indirectly. Right now in the world, it's hundreds of thousands of people that die every year based on these climate exposures. And the projections based on our modeling, which is some of the best way we know how to have a guess about what might happen, are that will dramatically increase a tremendous number of deaths. And I think an important question, important element of that is the amount of suffering that goes with it. And so that is, it's a natural human response to say, well, then we should do what we can to prevent that kind of suffering.
We are talking about climate change and health, mental health, physical health. And if you're listening to this show, you can find the entire audio at inotherwordsradio.com. And you can pass that link on to your friends if you want to share this conversation. Beth.
Yeah, just another element of the impacts of climate change on human health is the impacts of climate change on our financial system. Now, this is in part through the costs of health impacts and devastating storms and fires and loss of property and loss of coastal property particularly. And so I think because of a recent book and recent article in the Wall Street Journal that has a very prominent economist talking about some of these elements, this will be a very interesting thing to watch, because they're saying that the financial impacts of climate change are immense, and that we've known that insurance companies have been adjusting themselves for some time about this, but the corporate world has not been responding in the same way. And so that's an interesting addition to the conversation, and I'm just very keen to watch that. We know that it has a tremendous cost impact on health, and to think about the cost and financial impacts on the greater system is...
It seems like it's part of the larger conversation more than used to be. It was always, we can't afford to deal with climate change. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be a shift of we can't afford to not, even though that's been out there. There's more evidence, there's more research, there's more mainstream economists, corporate folks talking about that, which is, I mean, it's a little daunting, but it's also hopeful that mm-hmm. there'll be more pressure to actually enact the policies we need or the real solutions that we need. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot to think about in terms of our own personal inner map and our inner world of how we approach these things and work within our families and communities. And I really appreciate that, Kevin, Beth, and Jen, you folks think about this a lot. And I wonder if you could let us know how you stay hopeful and optimistic given sort of these daunting ideas. I mean, we've talked about it some, but maybe personally what you do to lean in a way that keeps you going and smiling and laughing and positive.
This is Jen. I'll speak for myself. I think part of what I've learned over time is I need to do it in moderation, that leaning in is very important. And there are also times that I need to lean out and just focus on having a good time or connecting with friends and maybe not talking about this stuff. That's not to avoid it or to deny it, but to I think we have to take care of ourselves if we're going to keep pushing ahead on this. So for myself, I spend a fair amount of time talking to my son about it. And part of that maybe is that I want him to know 20 years from now that I was thinking about this and trying to do something about it. But also because he's the next generation and they're going to be dealing with this problem too. So I want it on his radar, even if it feels a little scary. And I try to pair that with some hopefulness about things that we can do. So it's not just, again, scary and overwhelming. It's us as a problem, but we can work on this together.
Great. I know that a little bit, Jen, and I also do that with my daughter, and then they come back around, and I don't know if you've had this experience with your son, but, well, then why are we driving? We should be riding our bikes because it's not as much carbon pollution if we ride our bikes, and it's really wonderful when they come up with the
Helps to keep me a little more accountable if he shames me into behavior change. It makes it a little bit easier to stick with it.
Beth?
Well, I've said sometimes that I think this is an incredibly exciting time to be alive. I am just so curious. We see this incredible dilemma we're in, and I am just so curious as to what we're going to do. Because I am amazed with human ingenuity. I'm amazed with the resilience of the planet. And I just hope I live long enough so that I can actually see beyond sort of this next horizon. And so I think, to a certain extent, curiosity and faith in humanity helps me. I also, because we've talked about acting from our values, it's kind of like, well, my action is not that tied to a necessary outcome in a way, because no matter what, I'm going to try and live within what I believe, which is that the natural world is incredible and something that we are born of and a part of and dependent on. And so therefore, it only makes sense that I would be working to protect it. I mean, that's been, you know, in my way of thinking really since probably I was a pre-adolescent. And so in a certain way, it doesn't require that I have hope or optimism. I mean, I don't mean to sound glib, but it's kind of like, well, what else would I do? How else would I live? This is the way that I believe it's important to be in and to be contributing.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that, Beth. That's beautiful. You know, sometimes I think about top-down versus bottom-up change, and when I think about top-down change, meaning our leaders and policymakers making the needed changes for us to be able to make this transition, I get pretty discouraged. I mean, mm-hmm. there have been some signs worldwide and here nationally, but in general, I feel like our leaders really haven't been up to the task to date anyway. But in terms of bottom-up change, that's where my real hope lies, just in terms of all the people that I've met, both, you know, here in Western Montana, but also around the country and around the world, who are interested in investing in this issue and are trying to come together in meaningful and important ways in terms of creating change and moving our society towards one of greater environmental sustainability. You know, that creates active hope and optimism for me. But for me, part of it, though, is, you know, the uncertainty of our times, because this is really kind of a new era that we moved into as a species in my mind. Because if you look at previous generations, people pretty much assumed that their life wasn't going to be very different than their parents, grandparents' life.
Nor just will their a little better.
Yeah, maybe a little bit better, right? And for the first time, people aren't saying that. They're not thinking that their life is going to be, you know, about the same or even a little bit better. Like you say, there was always hope that with each generation, it was going to improve. Now people are for the first time saying, oh my gosh, it's going to actually be worse in the future. And so part of it is just trusting our resilience to really lean into that, to shift that, and to be able to make the kind of personal changes and transformations that are going to be necessary to be able to address this in a creative and in a meaningful way. And I'm encouraged by the fact that as humans, you know, we can do that. We can come together. We can build groups and communities and so forth where we can respond to this effectively. But the other thing about the uncertainty is what I would say is that a mentor of mine says the beauty of uncertainty is it makes you fully present. Because what she means by that is if you knew exactly what was going to happen in the future, you can anticipate and predict it, you wouldn't be alive. You know, the fact that it's so uncertain right now, it really brings a sense of aliveness. I'm with Beth in that way, that I'm really feel fortunate or blessed that I'm alive in this time in terms of all the things that are happening in our society and all the possibilities and so forth. And I think that there's an ability to engage it. Now, we can't necessarily totally direct or control it, but we can engage it in a way where we can savor life more, it can enhance our experience, but also we can be more connected to this beautiful universe story as it's unfolding around us. And to me, that's been one of the blessings, if you will, of climate change for me, is that when I look up at the sky and I see the clouds moving and the, you know, the stars at night and so forth, I recognize I'm part of something that's just so much bigger. And to me, that just adds more meaning and more depth and more spirituality to my life.
This is fascinating. I think I brought you mental health and health professionals together because then I would have to actually pay for your therapy sessions. I need to hear
the bill's coming,
Amy. The bill's coming out here.
What's your address, by the way?
No, it's wonderful to hear folks that think about it so deeply come out being either hopeful or not freaked out that they want to just stick their heads in the sand. And I don't know, one thing I've recognized is that a lot of us, I don't know, middle-aged folks are just a little daunted by what we do. And I see some of people a generation or two above me who are just having fun with making change and are really, they're psyched about trying to do what they can. And they're, you know, what really is the waning years, you know, of their lives. And then you work with college students and they're like, well, we can't give up because we got a lot of time on this planet. And there are so many opportunities. So there are a lot of times it seems even more positive and can probably learn from folks at all ends of that spectrum of where they are in their lives. This has been a wonderful conversation. Does anybody have anything they want to end with? So I want to, again, thank Kevin and Beth and Jen for sharing their ideas about how we engage and live in these uncertain but exciting times that we're in. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Really appreciate it.